A Rayo Original Podcast.
The best thing about being a man, you can hide behind productivity. You can hide by getting things done. I find other people's emotions difficult because I want to fix them.
Knowing that you were going to be blind, how did you deal with that?
If you have a car crash and you wake up different the next day, you've got this moment that you have to come to terms with.
Yeah.
And I never had that.
What is the thing with MI5?
As I went blind and applied to MI5 to be a spy, really. But there's 3,000 applicants and I got down to the last 30 before they decided they couldn't have a blind spy. And I fully support that decision. He can't even play I Spy!
Hello and welcome to another episode of Man Made. Today, a very good friend of mine, Chris McCausland. He is a fabulous comedian. He's got a book out, Keep On Laughing. He's a much better dancer than I am, having won Strictly the year that I was on it. It actually took us all of about 3 or 4 minutes before we mentioned Strictly, because it's all Chris and I can never really discuss. I mean, it's a lot better for him discussing it because he won it, not so much for me because I was, I was terrible. Chris is a very proud father, and it's always great to get people's takes on, fears they may have had pre-becoming a father and how he's dealt with that. He's also just an incredible person, so much so that he's recently won an award with Scope for being a role model. So we spoke a lot about role models and some of his. You will not want to miss this. Chris, thank you for coming on Man Made. We've pretty much done every podcast in the world together now. This is about our, fifth, sixth?
Well, I mean, they've all been yours.
Yes. Yeah. So, anytime I'm doing something, I'm basically like, let's get crazy.
Basically, what you've just said is that your output is all the podcasts in the world. Nothing else matters.
But there's a reason I keep having you as a guest, mate, and that's because they always do so well. Because everyone is just fascinated by you and loves you. Every podcast I do, you are one of the best guests that we ever have.
Well, I mean, you've set it up for a failure there, haven't you? Talk about raising people's expectations. When I'm on tour, I don't even walk out to music because it raises people's expectations. They go, what do you want to walk out to? I go, just silence. I'll announce myself. And then it can only go up from there, can't it?
See, well, I'm the opposite. I need a big fucking fanfare just in the hope people try and get excited at some point.
Do you know what used to annoy me as well? It kind of used to wind me up is that there's a Rocky film. Is it the Russia one?
Yeah.
Rocky 4, where he gets off the plane in Russia and there's a brass band there and it's playing the Rocky theme tune. And it welcomes him with the Rocky theme tune. Da, 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 da. And you're like, that has never existed in the film in a real sense. It's only ever been part of the soundtrack. How does Rocky know what that song is?
Well, I did request, I've just been, that's true actually. Oh, I didn't even think of that.
But do you know what I mean? It's only ever part of the score. They should play the American National Anthem or something. But like, they play the Rocky theme tune that Rocky's never heard.
Next time that I walk in and we have a guest here, if you guys don't have a brass band playing the Rocky theme tune for me to walk into this podcast, I'm going to be fucking raging. But no, this is a different podcast to what we've done before because we're just going to go a little bit deeper, I think, which is always nice. So we always start with the guests with a big open question. And for you, I kind of... For you.
Yeah. I'm just curious how when Pete says deep, how deep is deep?
Oh, well, it depends who you ask, mate.
Do you have mash or chips with your pie?
Do you have mash or chips?
Oh, mash with pie.
And then chips with?
Chips with not pie.
Not pie, anything but pie. Okay.
Mash with pie and sausages.
Well,
chips with everything else.
Well, this is a slightly...
Anyway, it's been nice to be here.
Thanks ever so much. And this will clip up and do really well. And then I'll get you on for the next one. No, slightly more deep than that.
Yeah.
I want to know what you think the best thing about being a man is.
The best thing about being a man is that you can hide behind productivity.
Right.
If the shit hits the fan, you can hide by getting things done.
Okay.
It's an acceptable avenue of behavior for a man. Well, it used to be more so than it is now. Now we're expected to confront our emotions and, you know, communicate on an equal emotional footing. But like, it has been an escape route for men for many, many years and decades and probably centuries and millennia. Back in the day, it was probably like, there'd be something emotional and something that needed dealing with. And they go, I'm going out hunting.
Yeah.
That's kind of carried on through centuries and centuries and millennia.
My old man was exactly the same. Like, you know, he'd always be at work and always go out and kind of do things and leave all the kind of emotional stuff for my mum. And I think that's kind of the way I grew up. And you just said there that now it's slightly different because there's an expectation, because we talk about men, for us to be like open and emotional. Are you?
Well, when I say it's the best, like, I mean, literally, you've put me on the spot here. So I've given
that's
you an
exactly
answer.
The point.
I've given you an answer that can be literally pulled apart in any direction you want. And when I say it's the best thing, I'm not saying that it's the right thing or it's the way things should be. But I think evolutionary, I feel comfortable and safe doing that.
Yeah, as do I.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Just the way my brain works, if the shit hits the fan and things get quite heavy in other ways in life, I find solace in work and I find solace in being productive and either actually being able to provide in other ways or at least kidding myself that I am.
It's weird. I mean, you just said, like, I'd put you on the spot with that. That's actually probably one of the best answers we've ever had. I completely get what you mean by that. Yeah. Anytime anything happens with me, what I do is just go and work or go and do something or do whatever else and having to sit down and have these conversations
I withdraw.
Are very difficult. Yeah.
Withdraw sometimes can mean that you just withdraw socially and you retreat within yourself, but you withdraw to your safe place, and your safe place can be sticking headphones on and listening to music or it can be work.
Do you find having conversations that are emotional or to do with feelings and all that, do you still find that difficult? And is it still something that you would rather not do?
I'm better with it now than I used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, it depends what it is. I do find it uncomfortable a lot of the time. I find other people's emotions difficult because I want to fix them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, I engage with other people's emotions like they are a leaky tap and I need to get a spanner out and tighten them. And then, but I don't want tightening. I just want a leak. And you're like, but you'll feel better if I can just tighten you. You need a new washer. Let me get you a washer.
But do you think that's because, I mean, you're an incredibly empathetic and compassionate man. Like, I know that. I know you quite well. You know, we did Strictly together, and over the past year, we've done lots of different kinds of work things and whatnot, and I see you quite regularly, and you are one of the kindest, most gentle blokes I've ever met, certainly behind the kind of the jokes and everything else, which I think is that a defense mechanism, being funny? Do you feel like you have to be funny all the time because it kind of takes away from other things?
Is it just because it's
your job?
It's a combination, isn't it? I used comedy before I was a comic, so it's obviously a mechanism for avoidance or for coping. For self kind of modulation, I suppose. But also, it is me job, isn't it? So you mentioned Strictly there. I wasn't going to mention it until you brought it up, but you brought it up now. I used it on Strictly a lot because I was so out of my depth in every other regard. It was the comfort zone and the safety net where I could go, oh, I can be me in these moments.
Yeah.
Because I am drowning in the other moments.
To be honest with you, me and you used to say it all the time. It was when we got up to the, like, Claudia's bit.
Yeah.
That was kind of the bit where we were both more comfortable.
Oh, God, yeah.
We'll just take the piss and be funny because it'll take away from the fact that, the dancing was shit. For you, it's slightly different. Because you were down there absolutely smashing the fucking life out of it.
No, I don't like to mention it, mate.
Well, no, I know. That's why I thought I'd get it in there quick. You know what I mean? Just so that it doesn't feel like you're mentioning it every time you have an opportunity and a mic in front of you. But part of man-made is about the fact that I think men struggle with role models, like young men now. There aren't many kind of strong role models.
Hang on a minute. I don't think that's right. I think there's loads of strong role models.
Well, I mean, you've just won an award for being a role model, so of course you're going to say that, aren't you?
the thing from...
Scope.
Scope, yeah.
Yeah. How does that feel?
So Scope's a disability charity, and they gave me... what was it? It was like a celebrity role model of the year.
Yeah.
It's weird. I mean, I get it. I appreciate it. But I don't think it's the biggest value in what you can do. I think everybody needs someone to look up to, and everybody needs inspiring. You need inspiring. I need inspiring. I've been inspired by a lot of people. And I think it's wonderful if you're in a position where you're able to do things that can inspire other people. There's a difference there in when you start referring to somebody as inspirational. A couple of people kind of tried to put that label on things during Strictly. I think that everybody needs inspiring to some extent.
Yeah.
It's something we all do for each other. But, you know, for me, the biggest value in the position I've been able to get myself into isn't really being able to be a role model or inspire other people who might come from a similar background or overcome the same obstacles or similar obstacles to me. It's about representing people and educating everybody else. And disability is so far behind where race and sexuality was many, many years ago.
Is that part of the reason that you, I know you've kind of spoken about it before, but you did Strictly?
Because I knew they wanted somebody blind on it. Yeah. And if I'm honest, I was terrified that I'd be rubbish. And if I was rubbish, it would do no one any good. But also, I kind of would have been really annoyed if they got someone else to do it who did the sob story with the violin.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. You never did
that. It
was
so difficult losing my sight over there. It would have really wound me up.
Doing Strictly, you never really mentioned or even really spoke about the fact that you were, it was everyone else that was talking about it.
Yeah, well, the whole point is, as I say, if you make people forget about the thing that they think defines you,
yeah,
then you normalize it.
Yeah.
And if I could make people forget that I was blind on that show, then it normalizes it. And there's no bigger thing that you can do than normalize the thing that people have got stigma about or
Absolutely,
people have got
yeah.
judgment about. That's been done very effectively with lots of other protected kind of attributes of people, whether it's race or sexuality and religion and things like that. But disability feels, you know, especially within the public eye, miles behind, really, in terms of people's expectations and so on. So for me, it's always about educating everybody else and showing everybody else that more is possible rather than specifically trying to be a role model for other people who might be going through the same things as me.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a byproduct, isn't it? And like, you know, if people have taken any motivation from anything that I've done, then I think that's a lovely place to be in, isn't it? Because I've certainly taken motivation from many, many other people.
Your old maths lecturer, is it a guy called Tim Ashmore, who I know you've spoken about in your book. Why was he kind of a role model for you when you were kind of growing up? What was it about him as a man that you kind of looked up to?
First of all, like, I was very lucky because I had plenty of male role models. I think if you're going to pull somebody out and single them out, it should be someone who maybe went above and beyond. So like my dad's wonderful, you know what I mean?
But
it's my dad and it's his job and he was always there. And, you know, even just the dads of my close friends growing up in Liverpool were all great, loyal dads. I think if you were to single somebody out and go, well, if it wasn't for them, life would have been very different.
Mm.
You know, it's probably him, Tim, because I probably wouldn't have gone to uni. Don't know what I would have done, really. I would have gone back to Liverpool with no plan. At the time, I just started kind of tinkering around on the guitar. And as I wrote in my book, I kind of wrote, you know, I could have ended up like lead singer in a rock band within 5 years. So if that had been the case, fuck you, Tim. Right? But thanks for nothing.
But that didn't happen.
No, that didn't. Could have done, though, couldn't
it?
Could have done. If he hadn't just got involved and interfered with his university talk.
Fucking, all right, so we start with fuck Tim is where we're going with this one.
What a wonderful, lovely man. And he was always just kind and compassionate and supportive. And listen, computers and maths were the only two things I was good at. And he really nurtured me with regard to maths and making me feel that I was good at something when I'm actually not that academic. And not only that, but really managed my anxiety around going to university, which I wasn't going to do because the idea of it terrified me because I was kind of just losing more and more sight. And the idea of going to this big, massive place with new people in a new place was just overwhelming. And he kind of managed me very well to the point where I went to uni, and it was probably like the best thing I could have done because, you know, I don't use my degree now, but like there's other avenues in life, but it's where I learned to be myself a lot more. It's where I, you know, met some guys who are like my closest mates in the world to this day.
So would you say outside of, I mean, like you said, you had a really like strong family unit that was full of great men, your dad, uncles and that sort of stuff. Is it one of kind of the first people outside of that?
It's people who kind of step up. They have no real obligation to be honest. I mean, plenty of people just turn up for the paycheck, don't they?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And some people kind of actually care more than just doing the job.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always stuck with me.
Well, I mean, the second person, which is Stephen Hawking, you mentioned as a kind of a role model. What is it about Stephen Hawking that is something that you kind of look up to?
There's a lot of things about Stephen Hawking that are just absolutely mind-blowing. Yeah. On a very basic level, he's a guy with an incredibly severe restrictive disability that would not just physically cripple, but cripple the willpower and the mind of most people. Mm. I suppose he transcended celebrity in a way to be one of the most famous people in the world. So he really, really excelled, and not in a in an area of disability or anything that was holding him back. He excelled in something that was so, firstly, mainstream, but also, have you any idea, even if you can, I've got your full faculty, like your full mobility about you, how difficult it is to be famous and that well known for being a thinker?
Yeah.
Like, it is remarkable that that is possible in this day and age. Like, because you go, you look back over centuries and, you know, there are some people that floated to the top. You know, everybody knows the name Isaac Newton.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows the name Galileo.
Yeah.
These are people who were famous, Einstein, famous for being thinkers when there was so much more to discover. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Isaac Newton is famous for going, God, gravity, like the things fall to the floor. And everyone's like, oh yeah, never noticed that before. And obviously,
famous for being thinkers for stating the obvious.
Yeah. But obviously there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
But what I mean is, like, but when you get to 1975, 85, 95, to still be able to be an individual that just is that well known, that successful, that iconic for just being a thinker.
Yeah.
Is remarkable. And then to do that on top of everything that, like, and not just...
But that's first and foremost. That's what people think about when they think about Stephen Hawking. The fact that he's disabled comes secondary to that.
I mean, it's
the incredible things he's done.
He's owned his disability.
Yeah.
He's made it part of himself. But he's also wasn't born like that. He was diagnosed as a young man.
It was when he was at university.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
So similar to myself, he's had a deteriorating condition.
Yeah.
So it's not something that he's been born with. He had to deal with that later in life. I was born with mine and it deteriorated from birth, so it was always part of me. He's had to come to terms with that at the point of getting into his field.
Yeah.
And also achieved the way he achieved through deterioration.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
When did you first find out about Stephen Hawking? When was he kind of first on your radar? And is it something that...
I've always been a geek, you know. I mean, I follow computers and maths through education, but I always loved space and astronomy and went from like the age of like 11, 12. You
Chris,
know,
is this a myth or did you... Is this thanks to you and MIT?
No.
Is that a joke? Because it
So MIT is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And what you mean
MI5. Sorry. It's because you just mentioned MIT out there to me, didn't you?
Yeah,
MI5.
Yeah,
what is the thing with MI5? Is this a joke?
No. It's 100% true. Yeah. No, it's just I was unemployed for 2 years and couldn't get a job doing what I was doing. But as I went blind and applied to MI5 to be a spy, really. There's 3,000 applicants and I got down to the last 30. Before they decided they couldn't have a blind spy, and I fully support that decision. I'm just glad they had the balls to stand up and say it.
Christ. I mean, listen, I thought I knew a lot about you, Chris, and in this
Can imagine somebody in MI5 arguing in a meeting, he can't even play I Spy.
For fuck's sake, Chris. Right, listen, we've spoken about Stephen Hawking and the fact that he wasn't born with his disability.
Wasn't born with wheels.
Yeah, he wasn't born. But obviously, it's taken respect to him. And you mentioned, similar to yourself, like you could see for the early part of your life, but it was a deteriorating condition.
Yeah.
How did... knowing that you were going to be blind affect you mentally? How did you deal with that?
Don't know. It's hard to say because
I suppose it's difficult.
If you have a car crash and you wake up different the next day, you've got this moment that you have to come to terms with.
Yeah.
And I never had that.
Yeah.
So it was drip fed to me over 25, 30 years. I mean, I think this is part of my problem with emotions is that you do become immune to sadness. You become immune to negative emotions. if you experience loss in an instant, I can imagine it could rip you apart, and you could
well, it can become consuming all
yeah,
at once.
Yeah, and you've got to come to terms with it, and it crushes people, and it motivates others to overcome it. But when you're losing something gradually over 30 years, it almost becomes just something that happens in the background, and there's never a moment you've got to come to terms with it, because it'll be different in a year than it was last year. And so you're always moving, you're always thinking you can see more than you can, and you're always moving into more of an unknown. There's frustration along the way. It's never anger, but it was frustration. There's things you can't do. There's things that wind you up. There's things you lose your temper about. The number of bloody things I banged my head into, or bent down to pick something up and twatted my head into a sink in a bathroom, or knocked things over that I forgot I'd put down a second ago, you know. You have to kind of take a breath and then go, okay, clean it up, move on, rub your head, whatever. Because if you let them affect you, then you'll never get anywhere. And I suppose over time, you just develop this kind of immunity to it. And the problem with that is, as I said, you know, I want to fix people if they're a leaky tap, you know. What it does is, I like to think that I'm empathetic, and I like to think that I care, which I do, but I do find that I have a lack of patience for people who handle things that are sad or negative or things that they're going through. And if they handle them differently to how I would handle them, outwardly, I can be very much like, oh no, that's awful. And like inside, I'm like, just fucking get over it. Jesus Christ. Pull your pants up, come on.
I do get what you mean.
Yeah, and I'm aware of that. I'm aware that that's probably not normal. And like, but you know, I do it.
Would you consider yourself to be confident? And is that something that you have kind of grown into? When you were younger and going through having to deal with the fact that you were losing your sight, did that affect your self-esteem?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been socially confident.
Yeah.
But confidence is just learned. I think, you know, I was socially confident because I grew up in Liverpool in the 80s and it was very sociable. You know, nothing I did was very rarely facilitated by parents. It was just go out and entertain yourself. And so you grow up with a social confidence. But confidence is learned. Like when I started doing stand-up, most never I can think of ever done in my life. Like at that moment, it was terrifying. Like it made me sick. I didn't have the confidence for stand-up. It was a dare to do it. And even when I'd been doing it a year and I was still working, I was working in a call center at the time. And I remember that like I would go out of an evening and do these gigs and enjoy it and get something from them. But then if there was like a meeting about a new product, and everybody was in the room and I had a question, I wouldn't put my hand up and ask it in case it was a stupid question. And then, you know, I didn't have the confidence for that in that environment. And so confidence is learned in different fields, really. And it's just, you know, it's something you get used to.
Like you said, it's slightly different now. And I do feel like we've got a lot of younger people now who aren't that confident. Do you think that's a problem? Do you think that's, you've got a daughter.
It's a huge problem, It's a combination between lack of experience. They don't have the experience of just having autonomy over their own movement and play and getting into trouble and engaging with people that aren't part of their bubble. And it's also a combination of this toxic online environment where they are only seeing the best and the worst of people.
Yeah.
They're not seeing the middle.
No.
The middle 80%. You know, they're seeing
extremes.
They're seeing the perfect lives and the absolute fuckwits.
Yeah.
And it's all perfection that they need to aspire to, or toxic hostility that they need to manage. I don't really see a way out of it, but it's, I mean, Australia are banning it now for under 16s, aren't they? They'll find ways around it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for kids who want to use Instagram, they'll find ways around it, even if you ban it. I don't really see a way out of it.
I was in a school a couple of days ago doing a piece about kind of young men and why they're kind of so angry. And this was kind of 14, 15-year-old kids. And a lot of what they were saying is that they felt angry, and they felt angry for a long time, and they felt sad and they felt lonely. But a lot of that comes down to the fact that they all said that they felt insecure and not confident enough in themselves. Does that worry you with your daughter?
It does, yeah. But like, I suppose that has always been there.
we just didn't speak about it.
Yeah, if a child doesn't know the words insecurity and like the idea of self-confidence, then they're not going to say that that's a problem they've got. But now there's just a lot more awareness of it on a, maybe there wasn't that awareness. It was always there and there'll be an outlet for it. Mm. But now there's an awareness of it. And I think a lot of kids feel broken.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think they necessarily felt broken in the past. They might have had the same conditions issues, but maybe they would have thought of them maybe in the past as being more the fault of everything around them.
Yeah.
Whereas I think now kids bring it in on themselves a lot more than they used to do. And they think that it's more them that doesn't fit in as much, you know?
We've had a lot of people that have come on this podcast that have, having kids has kind of changed them. Do you think having a daughter has changed you as a man?
Yeah, yeah, no, 100%. And I was so nervous about being a dad because everything was always for me about doing things as well as everybody else.
So were you nervous because of the fact that you couldn't see, or just nervous about being a dad?
It was entirely about not being able to see.
So do you think if you could see, would you have still been nervous about being a father?
I would have been nervous about, you know, when I started doing comedy, people would be nervous about going on stage and telling jokes. Mm. I would be way more nervous about the logistics of getting up onto the stage and the microphone and not fucking that up.
Yeah.
The nerves about the gig almost were secondary, whereas they might have been the primary focus of nerves for other comedians. And so, yeah, of course, I still would have been nervous about being a dad, and there was nerves there under the surface, but it was completely outshadowed by the nerves of doing it blind. Mm. I only like doing things, and I will only do things, really, I suppose, if I feel that I can do them as well as everybody else or, you know, within the same ballpark. And and I don't mind if I have to do 10 times more work to do it, but as long as that is possible. So I wouldn't be a comedian if I could only be half as good as everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that I can be as good as anybody else on me day, I don't mind putting in more work to get there.
Yeah.
Strictly. It was only valuable if I could achieve in the mainstream. Mm. You know, it didn't matter if I had to put twice as much work into some of it, as long as the outcome was comparable. That was the main thing. And whereas being a dad was different because going into it, I knew that there was loads of things I wouldn't be able to do as well as everybody else, as well as the other dads, because you've only got your own experience of fatherhood to gauge what a good dad is. My dad did loads of stuff with me, but a lot of the stuff that he did with me that I kind of thought made him a good dad is stuff I wouldn't have been able to do with my daughter. Like, I wouldn't be able to take her in the car and take her to a fairground and take her to a show. Like, the mobility, the logistics, the sitting down and doing the jigsaw with her. Do you know what I mean? All these things, once you get over a 12-piece jigsaw, become quite difficult when you can't see, you know?
So, I mean, the fear that you had...
I'm still working on the Little Mermaid, 50 pieces so they all become quite difficult. And then you're faced with the idea of, I'm not going to be as good as I think I should be.
Yeah.
And then you start feeling bad for your kid. You're going to have a dad that's just not as good as every other dad. And then we have my daughter. Mm. And then you realize that all this is just in my head. None of this is in her head.
Yeah.
You know, we all outwardly project our insecurities and our, you know, emotions and, you know, so I'm probably outwardly projecting a lot of my insecurities and a lot of my issues onto a child that has got no idea what the hell I'm worried about, because this is just normal to her. It took her existing for me to kind of clock that and realize that. And then it changed how I kind of related to myself a lot more.
So actually having your daughter actually changed the way you saw a lot of other things as well.
Yeah. And it changed how I related to myself and how I thought of myself, how I thought of myself as a dad, how I thought of myself as a bloke. It changed a lot of things. I mean, if it doesn't change you, then you are selfish, because it has to change you. Because it's the biggest job you'll ever get. If becoming an accountant changes you, then becoming a dad has got to change you more than...
Yeah, yeah. What would you say is the best thing about being a dad?
My father-in-law used to say to me, there's no such thing as a selfless act. I argued with him about this for ages, and he died during lockdown, but I think he won the argument. everything is selfish, he'd say.
Yeah.
And I go, what about this? And he'd go, yeah, but it makes you feel good, doesn't it? I go, yeah. Damn you!
Yeah. I've had that argument with someone before as well, and you cannot argue with that. If you do something you think you're doing it well, but it makes you feel better about yourself, it's not selfish.
Giving £10,000 to charity? Yeah, but I felt good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really fucking annoying, isn't it?
And so, basing it on that, I'm going to own the selfishness and saying the having a purpose.
Yeah.
And it giving you a purpose in life that is greater than any other purpose that you've had up until that point.
Do you think having a daughter has changed what you consider a good man to be?
So, I'd be hypothesizing. And I think the only way you can really probably judge yourself on that is if you have a boy for a number of years and then have a girl and see how the difference changes how you've parent both. You know, I've only got a daughter. It's hard to pull apart the difference between being the father of a daughter and just being a father. Mm. But yeah, you know, it. I'd like to think it's made me a better person. I'm not as good as listening and absorbing her anxieties and her, her emotions as me wife is. Mm. But, you know, I'm trying. I'm getting there slowly. It's certainly, I would like to think it does and it has.
I mean, we ask everyone what kind of two things you think make a great man. And one of yours is something that we've never had on this, which is devotion. What does devotion mean to you when it comes to kind of family, work?
Well, it's more than loyalty, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I've cheated there because I've taken loyalty and commitment and love and attention and care and thrown them all in the same pot. And I've boiled it up and called it devotion, you know? So I've got away with quite a few under the one thing there, haven't
I? I think it's a brilliant word.
But it's not a romantic thing, and it's not a marital thing, and it's not a parental thing. It's, you know, I have an extreme level of devotion to my close friends.
Yeah.
And so it's the people that mean something to you, whether it's your immediate family, your extended family, your friends, and yourself. And
so it's kind of the ability to go above and beyond for something that you genuinely really care about. Sticking fast.
No, maybe not. I don't know whether to go above and beyond, but to care deeply in many ways.
I love
more than you do about the things external to them, you know? I should have looked at the definition of devotion before I turned up, shouldn't I? Because I've just tried to define it there, but in a way that's probably...
Well, no, because...
But you know what I mean?
Because, I mean, listen, the definition of devotion is, you know...
Have you looked it up?
That's just in the dictionary. But what it means to you and the definition you is what's more important.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good way of describing so many things that actually do make up a good man. I mean, you're basically too intelligent for your own good, you prick, because we only asked for two words and you've just given us about 10 in one there, which is great.
I'm always looking for the loophole.
and the other one you've gone with, the responsibility, which would probably be one of mine.
Yeah, I think it's my safe space.
Yeah,
I'm
very similar on that. Yeah.
Work is providing money, it's providing security, it's providing the roof, it's teaching well, it's all these things wrapped up into one, isn't it?
And
I think that encompasses the productive side of my need to feel like I'm doing something. To feel like I'm contributing. As we said at the beginning, lovely little loop there, isn't it? But it is very convenient for me that is my place that I retreat to as a way of managing with things, is being responsible.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming in and speaking openly about these things today, despite being quite uncomfortable, you know, but technically it was work as well, so you've found a fucking loophole there and all.
Well, I mean, it would have helped if I was being paid. But, you know, I'm not, so I am going to say that. I'm on tour until May, and my book's out now.
Don't you worry.
Shut up, Pete. Paperback's out in May. It's called Keep Laughing. It's available on audio. It's available in hardback. Paperback coming soon. Tour till May. I'll be on tour again. Even if you listen to this in 3 years, I'll probably be on tour. Check it out. I might have another book out by then, so just Google me, see what I've got for sale, because these guys haven't paid me. Anyway, thanks for listening to Man Made, hosted by Pete Wicks. He's having a coughing fit in a minute.
Oh, Christ, I've just coughed up a lung there.
My name's Chris McCausland. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Oh, I've never had to not do an outro. Job done. Cheers, lovely. This is normally the bit where I will tell you everything Chris is doing, but he's done it for himself, which was fabulous. I'm sure you'd rather hear it from him than me. So yeah, go and check out everything he's just said. But make sure you come back, listen to the next episode of Man Made Pod. There'll be another one next week. Subscribe, follow, rate, review, do all of that stuff. You know the deal by now. All our social media handles are at Man Made Pod. See you soon. Ta-ra.
A Rayo Original Podcast.